Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. National Geographic is celebrating their 125th anniversary this year. The society was founded in 1888, January 13, by a group of 33 of the city's scientific and intellectual leaders who gathered to consider the advisability of organizing a society for the increase and diffusion of geographic knowledge. They've given us wonderful discoveries in various parts of the world, absolutely extraordinary photography, which has, because of new technology, become ever more sophisticated, and also an interest in discovery and adventure, and also environmental and historical preservation. This hour of the program, we are delighted to have two people intimately involved with the production of this terrific magazine. There's also a new book, actually, which I was looking at yesterday, a compilation of some of the historic photos that go way, way back, so it's a history piece as well. National Geographic 125 Years is the book, Legendary Photographs, Adventures, and Discoveries That Change the World. Terry Garcia is with us. Terry is Executive Vice President for Mission Programs. He was appointed by President Obama in 2010 to serve on the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling. Before joining the Society, he was Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere, U.S. Department of Commerce, and Deputy Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where he directed and coordinated the coastal, ocean, and atmospheric programs, including recovery of the endangered species. Terry, thank you very much for being with us. Should be a great conversation.
It's my pleasure.
Joel Satori is also with us. Joel has a job that so many of us, I'm sure, would say to him, "How do I get your job, Joel?" He's a wildlife photographer and a National Geographic Fellow. He specializes in documenting endangered species and landscapes in order to show a world worth saving. He's the founder of PhotoArc, a multi-year, PhoArc, I think it's called, a multi-year documentary project to save species and habitat. He says it is folly to think that we can destroy one species and ecosystem after another and not affect humanity. He has written several books, including Rare, Portraits of America's Endangered Species, Photographing Your Family, and Nebraska Under a Big Red Sky, Let's Be Reasonable, is his most recent book. Joel, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Isn't it something, Terry, 125 years? And what an important mission National Geographic still has. It's going to guide us into what I think you have said is going to be perhaps our most important century of exploration.
It is indeed. In fact, I truly believe that this is going to be the greatest age of exploration in the history of mankind. And there are lots of reasons for that, and hopefully we can explore some of that during this hour. But, you know, I wanted to mention at the outset that although people often think of us as a magazine, because, of course, that yellow border is well known to millions of people, or they may think of us as a television network that broadcasts documentaries, that's really not our mission. The mission, as you had described earlier, is to increase our understanding of the world and really to explore. And so at our heart, we're a scientific and educational organization, and we use our media as well as our scientific assets to increase understanding about our planet, about cultures, about the environment, as well as to, from time to time, explore solutions to some of the major problems that confront us.
Joel, what do you see as your mission?
Oh, my mission is pretty clear. I have to save life on Earth.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
Yeah, that's about it. That's all I have to do. Simply described in a way, but it's certainly not easy. My work since I started for the Geographic many years ago, more than 20 years ago now, has always been, I've always been interested in landscapes and endangered species and habitats and how people interact with the world we live in terms of extractive resources, energy, so forth. But lately, and proud to be associated with National Geographic missions now as a fellow, I've been going around and trying to do studio portraits of as many different species as I can to show the world that these species have a right to exist and that they are going away at an incredibly alarming rate. We're looking at possibly the extinction of half of all life forms on Earth by the turn of the next century.
Mm.
And so it's my job to try to wake up the public and get them to care. And I just figured doing studio portraits of as many different things with eyes as possible, mainly captive animals. We're at 2,700 species now, trying to get to 6,000 or 7,000 by the time I'm done 20 years from now or so. Would be a good way to get them into the tent and get them to think about more than the price of the pump and what's on TV.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you talk more about this, that it's folly for us to think we can destroy one species and ecosystem after another and not affect humanity. How are we affecting humanity?
Well, we've heard since we were children, all of us, that, you know, everything's interconnected in nature.
Mm-hmm.
But we tend to, as we get more and more isolated, we tend to stay more indoors, you know, socialize much. We certainly don't get outdoors as much. Most people live in cities now. And so as people are withdrawing more into temperature-controlled rooms, plenty to eat and drink if they happen to be fortunate, they lose the fact that there are connections that are vital for us to survive. Connections like we must have birds and insects and other species to pollinate crops, especially insects. And if we don't have insects to pollinate crops, primarily, fruits and vegetables are hard to come by. There are parts of China now that have lost their bees and even their flies due to pesticide use, and they're hand pollinating their fruits and vegetables using paintbrushes and little bowls of pollen.
Oh, really?
So that is something that's a very dramatic, drastic example of, well, we're losing something in the ecosystem, other species, and it affects us. But it could be something right here at home. It could be the fact that freshwater mussels or clams in this country, 75 or 80% of them are in trouble now and in need of federal protection. And that tells us that the water is either so altered or so polluted that they can't live there anymore. And since all of us depend on water, we all drink water, that really should be a wake-up call. And, you know, we could look at birds, we could look at mammals, we could look at any number of species to show us that we probably should change the direction that we're going in terms of reckless consumption of the Earth's resources. And there is still time to make a huge difference here. The game is not over by any means. But as a guy who focuses on endangered species and what's being done to save them, this is kind of why the photo arc exists. It's to really get people to care about the world. And each species provides us an opportunity to introduce them to these concepts and the fact that we're not alone, and it's very important. I mean, when we save other species, we're saving ourselves. True.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Joel, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Terry.
I was going to say that Joel raises an important point, and an interesting one, too, because we've supported more than 10,000 expeditions over the last 125 years, and many of them in the last several decades. And what we've seen recently, as you know, hundreds of photographers, writers, explorers have come through National Geographic and stopped off here on their way into the field in search for the truth, they have gone out and returned, and almost without exception, they have come back committed to helping the planet. They've come back as conservationists, really, because what they're all seeing, whether they're photographers or researchers or explorers, they're seeing that many things are slipping away from us. They're seeing natural, cultural, and historical resources disappearing at an alarming rate. And so what we hope to do with people like Joel, with our photographers and our explorers, is to use exploration, and Joel is engaged in a form of exploration, use exploration to inspire people perhaps to care, and also perhaps to care enough to take action. And ultimately, what we want to do is to, as part of our reporting, as part of what we do best, telling stories, is also to help people understand what the solutions might be to some of these problems. We won't tell people what to do, but rather, here are a suite of options that you may have available to you to address some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's right.
And are there, because of your long history and the nature of what you do, it's so profound and it's so beautiful, do people in Washington listen to you as to what it is we need to do to keep things from slipping away?
Well, I think they do from time to time. I won't say always, but certainly when we publish a story, say, on energy or on climate change, we do get attention. And, you know, we believe in the adage or there's a favorite quote that I have from E.F. Scripps, who said that if you give people light, they'll find their way. We like to feel that we're providing some light, and that if we do that often enough, if we can shine a light that's bright enough on some of these issues, that people will be able to use the information that we're providing to make change.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no better source than National Geographic. It's such a great institution. I always say it's bigger than any of us that work there. It'll be around long after we're gone, and it is a trusted source of information. And pretty much when we cover something, whether it's in the magazine or with missions, you can count on it being the gold standard and being the most up to date and the most accurate. We don't really have anything in mind other than bringing people accurate information, and there is no need to exaggerate anything.
Right.
So we're very mindful of our place there, and all of us feel very fortunate to work for such a grand institution, the likes of which does not exist anywhere else on the planet. Nowhere.
We're very thankful it's there, and we're very thankful it's been there for so many years. It's just one of those rare, very good things, right?
Yes, and you know, one example that I wanted to provide to you, and there are many of them, but how exploration can actually change attitudes, how it can change behavior. A number of years ago, a conservation biologist by the name of Mike Fay came to us, and he had proposed a project. It was a rather ambitious project. He was proposing that he was going to walk from Congo through Gabon to the coast of Africa, and he would catalog everything he saw along the way. He would do what he referred to as a mega transect, so every living thing, plant and animal. And he would do this on foot, and it would take him 2 years, covering about 2,000 miles to do so. And Mike also had another purpose in mind. In addition to the scientific knowledge we would acquire, he wanted to call attention to what was happening in perhaps one of the last pristine forests on the African continent, the fact that it was being logged at an alarming rate. And he hoped that, you know, perhaps he'd get enough attention from this project that the governments would set aside some tiny portion of land to protect it. And so he set out on this quest, and he walked 2,000 miles, encountered amazing sights, pristine forest, animals naive to humans. He finally made it to the coast where he saw hippos surfing in the waves and came back, and we reported on it. We published it in our magazine. We did a television show about it. We put him on the lecture circuit. And about a year after that, after Mike had been all over the country talking about what he and photographer Nick Nichols had seen, we received a call from the president of Gabon, President Bongo, and he wanted to meet with Mike, and he wanted to meet with Nick, and he wanted to talk about what they had been doing, because he had heard so much about it, because Mike had been, frankly, relentless. And they went to Gabon, met with the president and the cabinet, laid out all the photographs, and as a consequence of that meeting, the president and the cabinet said, "My God, we didn't know that all of this existed in our country. We didn't realize what was happening." And they said, "Not only are we going to set aside some land, but we're going to set aside 10% of the entire land area of Gabon as national park." And so rather than one park, which is what Mike hoped would be created, they created more than 11 national parks. And that was solely as a result of an individual and the images that he and photographer Nick Nichols captured, and then raising awareness and just telling people that it existed. And that caused something to happen. It caused action. It caused a head of state to sit up and take notice and do something very significant.
What an important story. And Joel, tell me, I like that quote that Sherry gave us earlier, providing the light and you'll find the way. How do you take that into the work that you do? Because we do, the pictures are extraordinary in National Geographic, and you linger over them, and particularly for me, the animal pictures. I just find them extraordinary. How do you provide, in terms of taking photographs, and particularly of endangered species, the kind of light that will allow people to find their way? How do you do that as a photographer?
That is a great quote, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
You know, for me, every story we go out on, if it's a conservation story, every story I do, whether it's a field shoot or something that's a studio shoot for photo art, we have that. We have Mike Fay in the back of our minds in a way. We all want to save the world as much as we can. That was such a tremendous achievement. For me, when I go out, I hope that every story can do that. Now, not all do. But on some, we move the ball forward a little bit, and that's enough to keep us going. You know, if you only move the ball forward a little bit in your lifetime, well, that might be enough. You can't save the whole world, but you might be able to save some of it. So for me, one of the best things that happened to me was a story on Madidi National Park in Bolivia, in which when we got done with the story, we learned that the Bolivian government was going to build a dam and drowned 1,000 square miles of some of the best rainforest left in that part of the world. And when the story came out, the headline inside the magazine was, Madidi, will Bolivia drown its spectacular new national park? And the government, upon seeing that story and having the world press ask that of the government, they decided not to build the dam. And more recently, I had a story out on koalas in trouble in Australia last year. And we ran a picture of 1 week's worth of dead koalas at a wildlife hospital. And they were koalas that had largely been hit and killed by cars or attacked by dogs.
Oh.
They had no defense. And not long after the story came out, the government of Australia finally, after years of prodding by environmentalists, finally said, yes, the koala in northern Australia is in trouble, it's imperiled, and it does deserve protection. Did that picture do it? I can't say that. Did that picture help? Yeah, it moved the ball.
Sure.
Absolutely. So those are the types of things that we try to go for in terms of we just want people's attention and we want them to care. And what they do is their own business, really. And if society as a whole does not care what we're doing to the planet, well, down we go. But we at National Geographic feel pretty strongly that they do care, that people just need to be shown what's going on in the world around them, and they will make the right choices if they can. Not all people are so fortunate as we are. We have the luxury of discussing this. We have plenty to eat. Our houses are warm enough in the winter and cool enough in the summer. And it really is up to the nations and the people in those nations that have resources to step up to the plate now, because the world needs it. It really does, more than ever before.
We're going to take phone calls for our guests, and we'll do so in a moment. There's so much to talk about. There's the whole world to talk about and saving the world. Our guest just speaking was Joel Sartori. He's a wildlife photographer and a National Geographic Fellow, specializes in documenting endangered species. He is the founder of PhotoArc, a multi-year documentary project to save species and habitat. He's the author of several books, including Rare, Portraits of America's Endangered Species. Also, Terry Garcia is with us, Executive Vice President for Mission Programs for the National Geographic Society. He has done a great deal of work in government as Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere, U.S. Department of Commerce, and has done work in the recovery of endangered species, habitat conservation planning, Clean Water Act implementation, and more. Two wonderful people to have as guests. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. It's the 125th anniversary of the National Geographic Society. They also have published a book that is lovely history and filled with photos of the expeditions that they have undertaken over 125 years and the issues, and there are many that have been important. National Geographic 125 Years is the name of the book. It's heavy. Can you tell? It's a runny, heavy book. There's a lot there. Phone calls from you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now. 800-486-8655. Joan in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Kathleen. Happy birthday, National Geographic. The last August issue was so wonderful because of the photographer and the print guy reporter who did Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Their caring and their community and the fact that they were accepted by the community out there and the traditional people out there was absolutely stunning. I go to the Church of Great Spirit here in Milwaukee, and because small churches are getting clobbered, if I ever have to quit any of the church communities that I participate in, I'm going to start my own, and it's going to be called the Church of the National Geographic.
Oh.
Thank you very much. That article received quite a bit of attention.
Yes.
and many, many comments, very similar to yours. And it did take an enormous amount of work and time for the photographer and the writer to become accepted in the community and to gain, you know, the trust and a willingness to work with us and let us tell their story.
We'd interview.
And that's often what we, you know, that's often the challenge, and I know that Joel can speak to this. Our biggest asset is our objectivity, our credibility, and our ability to go to a community and say, we'll tell your story, and we will do our best to tell it in a way that is credible and that is true to what's happening.
Mm-hmm. We had the privilege, Terry, of interviewing both the photographer and the writer of that Pine Ridge story, and people were greatly moved by it. We had on the radio station lots and lots of reaction, and I don't do it justice to say positive reaction. I mean, people were just wowed by that story.
Yeah, I as a photojournalist myself, Aaron Huey's the young man who did that. I think he worked on that at least 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's arguably one of the finest coverages of Native American life in modern times. Don Dahl, a Jesuit priest out of Creighton, had set the bar many years ago and had his work run in National Geographic for Native American issue coverage visually. And Aaron's work is just, it's very, very powerful. And you can tell he really put a tremendous amount of time in and has tremendous respect for the people that he covered.
How do you find all these people? It gives you faith in humanity. The world is a lot filled with a lot of good people who walk through the doors of National Geographic. Right, Terry?
It is. You know, we're privileged to be visited by hundreds, maybe thousands of individuals with ideas and proposals for us to consider. And the most challenging part of the job is selecting among all of these great ideas, all of these great proposals, the ones that we're going to pursue.
Right.
Because as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, there is so much left to explore. You know, we often think that, well, we've answered all the questions. Science has given us the insight into these problems. What's left? Haven't we filled in all the blank spaces on the maps? And I'm always amazed, always surprised that I can pick up the phone or someone comes in to visit and they say, we've got this great idea, or we've found this amazing thing that we want to tell you about. Let's go and find it.
How do you, I'm
it's a
sorry.
Like the, it's a little like the patent. The guy that ran the patent office, back in the 1800s, said, we're not going to need this office anymore because pretty much everything's been invented now.
Right.
Right.
No fear of that. And you know, one of the reasons that it is going to be such a great of age of exploration is technology. We have technology now that is opening doors that have been closed to us and frankly seem to be permanently closed if you were to ask someone the question 5 years ago. And yet now it's giving us insight into new discoveries, helping us find things that we thought had been lost forever. We can go places, we can see things, we can answer questions as never before.
And would you please explain how that has happened in the world of photography? Because there have been huge advancements that have changed the nature of what you do and allowed you to see more things, right, Joel?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, I just got two new Nikon cameras 2 weeks ago, and they have the ability basically to shoot at night. They have we have the ability, obviously, to switch back and forth from video to stills on our cameras. We have the ability to put cameras into remote situations where we view live what they're seeing. We can put them on bird's nests or on little robotic cars or helicopters to literally fly around or move around animals in the wild. We have the ability to shoot in infrared, so we don't even need visible light to get pictures. We did that with hyenas in Uganda, and I recently did it for the photo arc with a Madagascar mammal called an eye at a zoo that had to be photographed in complete darkness. Mm. So, yeah, the technology for me is really, really lovely. And it allows us to be less intrusive on wildlife as well. We have cameras that are completely silent and fired with a radio trigger. And so the animal never even knows it's having its picture taken. That's important to eliminate disturbance, and we don't want to scare anything away.
Mm-hmm.
We've really come a long way just in the last 5 years or so.
Mm. Thank you, Joan, so much for your call. I'm glad you were listening. Jeanette in Warren, Illinois. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, good morning. Joel, you have met hundreds of people in your travels. I was one of your equipment Sherpas back in Northeast Iowa in 2007 when I was working
for the snail?
The Fish and Wildlife Service.
Was it for the snail?
And yes, for the snails and the monkshood. And you let me play with one of your nice digital cameras. It was the first one I'd ever handled, and it's inspired me to pursue my photography some more.
Oh,
and
good.
You're talking about long hidden things. Yeah, the Iowa Pleistocene snail is something that was lost and then not found until about a century ago again.
Yeah.
And in Northeast Iowa and this region, I've been shooting lots of photos, giving a number away, and I'm just getting my own website now. I don't think I'm going to quit my day job, but getting to meet and see some of what's out there is something that you helped remind me of. My family's been a National Geographic subscriber since mom's dad or grandpa. We don't have the very first issues, but we have a lot of them. And I look forward to seeing your work in future issues again.
Well, thanks. I was just looking at those pictures the other day. This was a project on when I was doing the rare book for National Geographic and the magazine story. One of the species I'd always heard about was a little bitty snail. Some of them are just the size of a pencil lead, not even a pencil eraser, and they have to be photographed in place because they live in cold air vents in the side of rocky outcroppings in northeastern Iowa, and they're a Pleistocene relic. And that ice, isn't that ice in those hills left over from the Pleistocene, and that's what's creating the cold air vents?
Well, the formation is something that enables these ice age plants and animals to remain there. But when we have a good winter like this winter, where we do have some cold weather, we do have some snow, that will build up some ice that will then be slowly melting through next summer and enable these animals to live. And so that's why global climate change is a huge threat to some of these very sensitive animals, that they can't go any distance away because they're totally dependent on those cool air slopes.
We actually had to photograph them in the rock cracks themselves. We had to slip these little bitty tiny black and white backgrounds into the cracks of the rocks and photograph them right in place in the field. That was an adventure, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it sounds like an adventure. Yeah. Thank you, Jeanette. Thank you so much for the call.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Yeah. Nice to know that what you've done stays on, lingers on, influences people.
That's
good to know. Terry, let's talk about some of what's ahead for this particular century. Will a lot of it be the ocean?
Well, certainly a lot of it's going to be the ocean, since we've only explored maybe 5% of the ocean, and that's probably a generous figure. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we now have the technology that's allowing us to go deeper and deeper. In fact, last year, we, along with Jim Cameron, went to the deepest point on the planet, the Mariana Trench, and that was that was the first time in more than 50 years that a human has been to the deepest point in the planet, has explored this region. And if you think about it, we've sent dozens of individuals into space. We have landed men on the moon, and yet in our own backyard, only once in 50 years had we been to that deepest point in the ocean. And so that, I think, will begin the new age of exploration, over ocean exploration. So there are huge opportunities there. One of our explorers, Bob Ballard, likes to say that there is more human history under the ocean than in all the museums in the world.
And the reason it's hard to get there is because it's so deep, it's hard to get equipment down there? What's the reason?
Well, it's expensive. It's the going to these depths, the pressure is enormous. And so you have to be able to build a craft that can withstand unimaginable pressures at those depths. And that's what Cameron and his team were able to construct, a manned submersible that was able to go 7 miles down and withstand the enormous pressure, the cold at those depths. But also just maintaining a ship in a remote area of the ocean is challenging at times, and it's expensive. And so you have to get people out there, keep them on board, spend protracted periods of time, sometimes months, engaged in research and exploration. It's not for the faint-hearted.
No, I'm sure it's not. Here's an email that's come in from Nick in Milwaukee. I've loved National Geographic ever since my grandpa read the magazines to us as kids and showed us those fabulously captivating photos, and I'm a huge fan of Joel Satori and his work. My favorite blog is A Voice for Elephants, and I'm closely following the tragic elephant deaths and poaching atrocities and the issue of blood ivory in the news recently. I'm wondering if National Geographic plans to play an increased role in the blood ivory issue. Do you have any insight into the situation or comments to share? Thank you so much. Nick loves you both.
Well, the article received quite a bit of attention, and I think your audience will be interested to know that this year we're going to be premiering a television special on blood ivory. And you know, really tracing the sources of the demand, who is buying this stuff, why are they doing it, and helping people understand what's driving this market. And stay tuned, because this is going to be a hard-hitting piece of investigative journalism, just as that article was. So yes, we're going to continue to cover this very important issue, which is impacting in a very dramatic way the health of elephants in the wild.
And you know, I was talking with somebody that's really into elephant conservation in North America, a man that manages a big zoo and wildlife park in the U.S., and he said that that many of his colleagues are worried now that they'll lose the elephant in Africa eventually.
Oh.
They're trying to build captive herds in the U.S. or at least get the breeding straightened out so that the elephant can continue to live if it does not survive this onslaught on the continent.
Mm.
That's really a bold statement, but that's how they're thinking long term right now.
Joel, have you photographed a lot of elephants?
I have done that, yeah. Yeah, in Africa and in Uganda and Mozambique, and also in zoos, actually, around the world as well.
So tell me about them. They just seem to be extraordinarily intelligent, and they're just so beautiful.
They are. I mean, they're extremely social. They have their intelligence is among the highest in the animal kingdom, and they're better behaved than humans in many cases. They're also a major sculptor of the landscape. A lot of other species depend on them. They knock down trees. They create mud wallows. They deepen holes in the ground that keep water longer. They literally are a keystone species wherever they are for the survival of many other species. So it's really, really important we get a handle on this. And my opinion is that we really need to try to go for the sources of consumption of ivory, and hopefully that would dry up poaching. Like if the Chinese are consuming ivory for decoration. We need to educate people as much as we can, and the Blood Ivory story did a good job of that. But the message needs to get out, really, to folks like Chinese school kids to know that ivory's not pretty. There's nothing pretty about it. It comes from killing elephants. That's how you get ivory. And that I think that message can get out. It needs to get out. And that's really the way to stop it. Mm. And same with rhino. The rhino's headed for the same fate if we don't get a handle on the consumption of horn.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to say, for those who want to know more, the television show that I mentioned a moment ago is going to premiere on February 27th on PBS.
On PBS?
On PBS.
Okay, wonderful. I will make a point, and
so
I'm
be sure
our listeners will, too. There's a picture, and I can't remember the circumstances of it, but in the book that I was referencing, National Geographic, 125 Years, there's a picture, it's some eastern nation where I believe somebody has climbed up on top of an elephant to clean his teeth. Do either one of you remember that, what the context was of that picture in the book?
I do not know that picture, believe it or not.
It's a great picture. It stayed with me. A lot of the pictures do.
Yeah, I think it was in Ceylon.
Okay. Yeah. Huh.
But I don't know the exact circumstances, but I recall it because it was of a fellow who was cleaning the elephant's tusk.
Yes.
The elephant was sitting beside a river.
Yes, yeah, it's a beautiful picture. Oh, so many of them are.
Yeah.
Let's go back to phone calls. Let's go to, our lines are filled, Gail in Door County. Hi, Gail.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Happy birthday. This is, like, so wonderful that we're making a stride, but it's so slow when it's just a little bit at a time. And listening, I had to call and share one of the things I keep plugging away at for the causes I work with is Gandhi, when Gandhi said, when the people lead, the leaders will follow. And that's something that when I get discouraged, because we work hard at trying to make a change, and sometimes it's like a step forward and then a step or two back, and we have to plug away at it again, and I keep thinking of that. When Don Henley had said a story about how he was always fighting for causes, always getting in fights and arguments when he was younger. And his dad said, boy, if you're going to pick a fight, pick one big enough to count but small enough to win.
Mm.
So we all want to heal the planet, and that's our biggie. But if we think of it as the universe, it's a small fight. And that kind of keeps me encouraged, and I wanted to share that. So keep up the good work, everybody.
Thank you, Gail.
Thank
I'm glad you,
so you
called.
Much.
That's very nice. Greg is next. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I have a dairy farm in Annawan, Marathon County. And this past summer, we have a property on a small lake off the grid in northern Wisconsin. And I kind of took on a project of photographing two loons raising a young. And I worked at it weekly and managed to do well enough to have it being put in an exhibit in Antigo in March and April. And I guess I just wanted to say, maybe shamelessly plug the exhibit, but also say that it gave me quite an appreciation for what these people are doing and wanting to share that with other people. So I just thought I'd call and let you know about that.
Terry.
Thank you very much. You know, I think Joel can probably comment on some of the hardships and challenges of being in the field. We, our photographers go out and they spend sometimes months trying to capture just that right image, the perfect image, and take thousands of images while doing so. But what they have to do to capture an image is almost as interesting as the image itself. And Joel, I know you've had a number of adventures where you've been out in the wilderness encountering unusual sights and experiences.
Yeah, we're all pretty good at being miserable. I like to say that. I went to lunch with some folks yesterday. I went up to the Omaha Zoo to work, and we went to lunch, and didn't matter what they put in front of me, I ate it. And the other people were being picky. said, what's going on? I mean, you have a tapeworm or something? And I said, well, not now, but, and also you cannot afford to be a picky eater. You know, you eat whatever locals are eating, and you sleep wherever they're sleeping, and you get very sick at times. I've had a flesh-eating parasite.
Ooh.
Screw worms dug out of my back with
Ew.
A rusty machete, and
Ew.
You know, but you're not going for that. You're going because that's where the story is that needs to be told, and you take all the precautions you can. But and it makes a good these make good stories for now when we're on the radio. So
yeah, they
always,
sure do.
It's always good material, and we hope that our trials and tribulations will be temporary. That we will be able to return home and resume life as normal. But what fun would it be, I guess, if it was all really easy? Everybody would be doing it, right?
Mm-hmm. And the mission...
Well, you know, I'm sorry, I was going to say, and the heartening thing about this is that Joel has now told you about some of the hardships that are encountered, and these are hardships that are experienced by explorers as well. But for... You know, every Joel out there, for every explorer who's out there now, there are two or three or four or a dozen who are willing to go if only they had the means.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's good to know that there are individuals who are so driven, who are so focused, who are so committed to these issues that they're willing to withstand these hardships and do what's necessary to carry back these amazing stories to us.
Right. And that's a history that's gone back 125 years, longer than that, but for National Geographic, some very important and extremely dangerous expeditions for a long time, right, Terry?
Some time.
Absolutely. For 125 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we have sent, you know, the ambition of the early founders was to go farther, higher, and deeper than anyone had gone before, and then to tell the story
mm-hmm.
so that others could experience it. And that's what they've done. And that's what the more than 10,000 expeditions that we've supported have experienced or allowed us to experience.
More phone calls in a moment. National Geographic is 125 years old this year. In addition to the TV shows, the documentary, we want to for those of you because we talked about elephants. We did a great show about elephants a little while ago, but draw your attention. February, the PBS show, the National Geographic TV special on Bloodway, about elephants and harvesting them for ivory. Which just shouldn't be done, so the more people know about that, the better the world will be. They just give us so much, the magazine and the television shows, and the book, too, is quite extraordinary for those of you interested in the history. It's National Geographic, 125 Years, Legendary Photographs, Adventures, and Discoveries That Change the World. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Rhonda, oh, good for you, Rhonda. Rhonda is going to report links to our archives on Facebook to some National Geographic shows that we've done in the past, because we've done quite a few of them, and every single one is a gem as far as I'm concerned. They're all wonderful people and extraordinary stories. So she'll do that for us, which is good. This hour, Terry Garcia, Executive Vice President for Mission Programs for National Geographic Society. Joel Sartori, Wildlife Photographer, National Geographic Fellow. He's doing some important work. They both are to save the world. How about that? To save the world. More phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your calls, Scott in Madison. Hi.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Fine. How are you, Scott?
Fine, thank you.
Good.
Happy birthday, National Geographic. My name is Scott Wright, and I'm here in Madison now. But back in 1994, I was in St. Petersburg, Florida, where I work for the Department of Natural Resources, and I was privileged to do a photo shoot with Joel Sartori.
Ah.
And he took photographs of me in my laboratory. We were doing a necropsy on a manatee, and his very, very powerful photograph brought great attention to the plight of the manatee at that time. And it was just a terrific experience to work with Joel. So I wanted to give a shout out and say hi.
Well, thank you. It's really good to hear from you again. I remember you had a waterproof room, and you could hose off the ceiling lights even because of the explosive nature of necropsing.
Well, that's true. That's an interesting you remember that. But
yeah.
I would say that, giving a shout-out to my scientific colleagues, in a way, some of my colleagues were, how shall we say this, a bit jealous perhaps, and they criticized me for wanting all the attention. And my answer to them was, well, okay, you know, it's good to scientific journals, but by golly, how many people read those scientific journals compared to the numbers, the millions of people that read the National Geographic?
That's right.
And get the idea out to the public is the most important thing we do, and so big, big thank you for that.
Mm. Well, it was my privilege to work down there, and the goal for all of us is to try to get people to slow down. The number one cause of death for manatees at that time was boat collisions, right?
Mm-hmm. And it still is.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Great memory.
Austin and Delavan, hi.
Good morning, Joy. Happy birthday, National Geographic. I'm calling to ask if National Geographic's aware of the problem with the bees in this country.
Terry?
We are indeed. Many of our scientists have been studying this problem, and we have reported on it in the past, and will continue to do so. But you're referring to the die-off of bees in North America.
Are they familiar with the neonicotinoids that have been banned in some countries in Europe?
I'm sure they are, but now you're wandering into an area that I'm not familiar with.
Thank you, Austin, for calling in. Let's go to Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Hi, I had something to say about the bees before I say anything else. I had six hives up in Burnett County, and I had three die of Israeli paralytic virus. And I welled, and I took my oxyacetylene tank, my oxygen tank, and I blasted them four times a day for about 10 minutes. Real slow, but pure oxygen. And I didn't lose any more hives. And plus, I had them swarm. So I think it's an oxygen thing. I think the spiracles on their abdomens are what's doing it. But what I wanted to say was, your movies are fantastic. I love them, but I'm really into science. And the last scene on The Monarch by National Geographic is more closely related to a red-spotted purple or something like that, like a white admiral, because it's a Batesian mimicry. It's a viceroy butterfly. And to show something like that to people is wrecking science. I mean, seriously, you want to show the monarch, you want to show monarchs, not their mimics. So I just wanted to say that. Look at it and watch it. But have a good
understand.
Day.
Well, I'm glad you're watching it, and I'm glad you're paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very closely. People are always there to get you for something or another. ain't it the truth? Even though you do the best possible work, but I guess
well but you know that, and that goes to Joel's point earlier that people hold us to such a high standard, and
right.
You know, it may seem odd, but I like to hear comments like that.
I don't mind it either, actually, because
yeah.
It keeps us on our toes. You know, like
right.
About all I know is the viceroy's slightly smaller, darker, and has different white spots on the trailing edge of the wing, you know, and the monarch's bigger, and that's the one that really, really gathers
mm-hmm.
giant wintering groups in Mexico. But we're always on the lookout for inaccuracies. Geographic has a research department, and everything that goes in the magazine, at least, is checked out thoroughly, and we try to just have zero errors when we
right. Right, which is not
But we have
possible.
Millions of people who are keeping us on our toes.
Oh, yes, I know.
Yeah.
We only have about 15 seconds left. Please,
yes.
Once again, the elephant special is in February. Did you give me a date, Terry?
February 27th.
27th. And the book has just been released, National Geographic, 125 years. It's gorgeous and historic and everything that you would expect. And should we be reminded of anything else other than we should all save the world?
Save the Earth.
Save the Earth.
You bet.
Keep reading the magazine and watching our television
Keep
show.
Being curious, and I'd encourage everybody to have an open mind and mm-hmm. discuss things.
And support exploration.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, thank you. You guys are wonderful. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Terry Garcia, Executive Vice President for Mission Programs for National Geographic Society, and Joel Sartori. I'm amazed how many of you have met Joel. He's a wildlife photographer, National Geographic Fellow, and he has done this wonderful work. He's the founder of the Photo Ark, which is a documentary project to save species and habitat. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and many programs with National Geographic, and for on-air production as well. Great conversations ahead. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network.